Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. For over a month, Indian-controlled Kashmir has been on lockdown. Indian security forces have swarmed the Muslim-majority territory. Internet service phone lines have been shut down almost all the time. And it began when India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi made a move to end Kashmir's autonomy. Well, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan last week warned the world that India's move could trigger a war. Modi thinks Pakistan is bluffing. Maybe so, although it is worth remembering that the nuclear-armed neighbors have fought two wars over Kashmir. So this hour on Point, India, Pakistan, and the tensions now unfolding in Kashmir. And you can join us. What is your question for the situation currently in Kashmir? Do you worry that India and Pakistan could once again go to war? We want to spend a couple of minutes on the news this weekend about U.S. efforts to clinch a deal with the Taliban in Afghanistan and possibly bring United States troops or withdraw them from Afghanistan. So joining me now is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Karen DeYoung. She's associate editor and senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post. She's with us from Washington, and we have links to her reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Karen, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hello.
So first of all, let's just talk briefly about the news around the decision and then undecision, I guess, from the White House to invite the Taliban to Camp David here. First, what is the immediate fallout from all that happened on that front in the past day or two?
Well, I think the immediate fallout is no one knows now what the future, if any, of the peace negotiations that have been going on between the United States and the Taliban for the last 10 months. It's not clear whether they're finished. I think they felt like they had come to a deal, and the question was, how was this deal going to be finalized? Who was going to sign it? Where was that going to happen? And all of a sudden, the president announced late Saturday night via Twitter that he had invited the Taliban leaders and the Afghan president to Camp David to talk with them separately. And it was clear that he hoped to come out and kind of like Jimmy Carter with Arafat and Sadat come out, and I'm sorry, with Begin and Arafat come out and sort of announce a deal. But he said in the same tweet, the deal is off because the Taliban had launched an attack in Kabul several days earlier in which an American serviceman was killed.
Right. So on that point, though, Karen, there, first of all, have the Taliban actually confirmed that they received an invitation from the White House?
No, they haven't said. What they have said is that, look, we thought the deal was completed. We thought everything was finished. We were just figuring out when and where it was going to be signed. They haven't mentioned any invitation from President Trump or any plans to come to Camp David. And so we don't really know if they received that invitation and actually plan to come.
Right. It does make you one wonder, though, about the impetus around even the idea to bring the Taliban to Camp David, because there have been multiple attacks in recent weeks, deadly attacks in Afghanistan, launched by the Taliban. Was that not enough to give the White House pause in even thinking about this invitation?
Well, I think that this was a kind of a spur-of-the-moment decision to do it in the first place, and equally spur-of-the-moment to not do it. There have been 16 U.S. service members killed in Afghanistan this year. It's tragic when another one is killed, but the fighting has been increasing there, as one would expect, as they grow closer to a deal, and every side wants to get leverage. I mean, as Secretary Pompeo said on television yesterday, the Americans have killed 1,000 Taliban in the last 10 days. So there has been an increase in fighting. Some would say all the more reason to get this deal underway.
Mm. Well, we actually have that moment here that you just referenced from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on CBS's Face the Nation. He was speaking to host Margaret Brennan, and here it is.
We've killed over 1,000 Taliban in just the last 10 days. So it has not been the case that we've been negotiating with our hands tied behind our back.
So 14,000 is where it stays for the foreseeable future?
I can't answer that question. Ultimately, the president's
decision. Okay, because it was in the deal that within 135 days it was going down to 8,600, and the president said that was happening.
We are absolutely intent upon ensuring that we reduce the risk that we'll have more folks coming back through Dover.
That's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on CBS's Face the Nation. And you heard Margaret Brennan there referencing 14,000. That's the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. So, Karen, do we have any more information about where Mike Pompeo left off that interaction there? I mean, what is going to happen with all the U.S. troops there?
Well, we don't know. I think that the plan was that an initial somewhat more than 5,000 of the 14,000 that are there now would be withdrawn, as the Secretary said, in the first 135 days. The hope was that the rest of them could be withdrawn by the end of next year, which conveniently would put it around the time of the presidential election here. One of the arguments in the White House was whether the president could go ahead and withdraw these 5,000 troops and leave around 8,600 there without really affecting the fighting capacity of the Americans and their ability to train the Afghan troops and everything else that they do. And I think some people, in particular the National Security Advisor John Bolton, had advised the president that he could do that and that he would therefore get credit for a withdrawal, if not a full withdrawal, and would not have to sign a deal with the Taliban.
And finally, Karen, I mean, one keeps wondering what the future of these talks are here, because you mentioned the Afghan president a couple of minutes ago, but Afghanistan President Ghani wasn't even part of these discussions to begin with. I mean, I'm seeing reports here that American officials wouldn't even leave him a copy of the draft agreement. So how is this all going to function? How is the agreement going to get to the finish line?
Well, I think that was a problem throughout, where the Taliban had always said they didn't want to talk to the Afghan government. That was a puppet of the United States, and they would only talk to the United States. And that, for many years, had prevented any talks. And finally, the Trump administration said, okay, we'll talk to you. And as part of those talks, the agreement was that after they gave the Taliban what they wanted in terms of some troop withdrawals, and the Taliban gave the Americans what they wanted in terms of severing ties to al-Qaeda, that the agreement itself would include a commitment by the Taliban to talk to the Afghan government, and that was supposed to happen in the next several weeks after the finalization of the agreement. Now, we don't really know what's going to happen.
Well, Karen DeYoung is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and an associate editor and senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
All right. Now, let's switch gears a little bit here and talk about India, Pakistan, and Kashmir. And joining us now in the studio is Adil Najam. He's dean of the Pardi School of Global Studies at Boston University and former vice chancellor of the Lahore University of Management Sciences in Lahore, Pakistan. Adil Najam, it's good to see you again.
Thank you.
Also with us from New York is Ravi Agrawal. He's managing editor at Foreign Policy and co-author of its South Asia Brief newsletter, former CNN bureau chief in Delhi, out of New York City, and also author of India Connected, How the Smartphone is Transforming the World's Largest Democracy. Ravi, welcome to you.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
So, Adil, let me just start with you. And I don't actually want to leave this Afghanistan question entirely behind here, because Pakistan is a major player in the region regarding the United States' strategic interest in Afghanistan. I mean, I was seeing here that Senator Lindsey Graham was advising the president to focus on U.S.-Pakistan relations in trying to, contain the Taliban. So what's your take on where we are now here regionally?
We are in one hell of a mess. We've always been a mess, but we are even outdoing ourselves even by the standards of that region. Afghanistan has fallen apart. That's not a surprise. No one really expected this to work. This was, but it's falling apart at the same time as the Kashmir crisis is blowing up. And Kashmir this time is not just an India-Pakistan issue, it's very much an India-domestic issue. And there are other parties too, like China, which also has a claim on Kashmir. But the Afghanistan angle here for Pakistan is that in some ways, the U.S. has been, Mr. Trump has been banking on Pakistan to quote-unquote deliver Afghanistan. Pakistan has never had the capacity or ability to deliver Afghanistan. But what the Kashmir crisis does is it distracts Pakistan from even whatever it could do, which is very limited to begin with. So this is in many ways Pakistan's worst nightmare on both flanks. On its east, India and Kashmir blowing up. On its west, Afghanistan blowing up, neither of them liking it. And so this is the scenario that the military in Pakistan has always been most afraid of, the two-flank squeeze.
And here we are. I mean, so Ravi, what's your take on that same question?
Well, Pakistan actually has tried to link the issues of Kashmir and Pakistan. And I think Imran Khan recently said that the two were linked, and then that got a response from the Taliban, which said that it was actually pointless to link the two issues. They're completely separate. So I guess there's that. But I think what's clear is that, and I completely agree with Adil, is that both of these outcomes, the collapsed peace talks in Afghanistan and India abrogating Article 370 and revoking some autonomies of Indian-administered Kashmir, both of these moves are not good for Pakistan and for the administration of Prime Minister Imran Khan. And so it remains to be seen what he's able to do to mitigate those things. I think his options are more limited in Kashmir, and we can discuss that a bit further. But in Afghanistan, of course, this is an issue that has served to destabilize both sides for many years. And will likely continue to.
Well, we are talking this hour with Ravi Agrawal and Adil Najam about the situation in Kashmir in particular and the rising tensions between India and Pakistan. And we want to know what your question is. First of all, do you fully understand the history and the sources of the tension in disputed Kashmir? What's your view on the fact that two nuclear-armed states were talking about perhaps being at the precipice of war yet again? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the Indian clampdown in Kashmir and rising tensions between Pakistan and India. I'm joined today by Adil Najam. He is Dean of the Party School of Global Studies at Boston University. Ravi Agrawal also joins us. He's managing editor at Foreign Policy and co-author of its South Asia Brief newsletter. And do you know anyone living in Kashmir right now? Have you been able to hear from them in the month plus of the Indian crackdown there? What is your question for our panel about the rising tensions between India and Pakistan? Now, Adil and Ravi, you know, I actually do want to take a step back here because the conflict over Kashmir is so long, so deep, and so passionate in South Asia that I think it's one of those global disputes that people may have heard of or talk about as if they know what's really going on, but don't really, because it's really complicated. So Ravi, just give us sort of your 101 primer here about why is there such a dispute between India and Pakistan over Kashmir?
Sure. Well, it all goes back to 1947 when the British were leaving the area of India, and India was partitioned, as it's called, into India and Pakistan. Pakistan being for the areas that were majority Muslim, and India being for areas that were majority Hindu. Pakistan was founded as a Muslim state, as it were, the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. India was founded on the premise of being a secular nation. Kashmir was the anomaly in that it was a Muslim-majority state or region that ended up being part of India and not Pakistan. So that's sort of the genesis of the problem, in a sense, because Pakistan felt that Kashmir should be a part of its territory and not of India's. In 1947, when India was sort of corralling various princely states and regions to join the project of India, Kashmir was actually on the fence, in part because it was a Muslim-majority state. But what ended up happening is that there was an invasion of sorts from across the border in Pakistan, and then Kashmir's leader at the time turned to India and asked for help, and India offered its help and protection on the condition that Kashmir joined the Union of India. That's what happened. But at that point, what India ended up promising Kashmir was certain autonomies, and those autonomies included the fact that Kashmir had it could make certain decisions on its own, mm-hmm. for how it conducted business and affairs in the state, not foreign policy, but at least certain issues. It had its own flag, for example, and crucially, non-Kashmiris were not allowed to buy land in the state of Kashmir. So that's sort of the history. And then, of course, that is a territory that the two countries, as you said earlier, have fought at least two wars over.
And it's that autonomy that Modi suspended a little more than a month ago here. So we'll get to the present day in a moment. But Adil Najam, give us your view here about the source of the tension.
I think generally Ravi is right. But in Kashmir, it's not just the territory that is an internationally disputed. It's neither India's nor Pakistan's, but disputed territory also between China. But it's also the history that's disputed. Generally, I think Ravi is exactly right. Just to add some things to, as he said, the British Empire was being partitioned. There was a highly incompetent, really incompetent and petty person doing it by the name of Mountbatten. And he left many, many things unfinished, including Kashmir. One of these deals was that the princely states, and there were over 100, were going to decide, these were states within the empire that had pseudo autonomy, which side they go to. Kashmir was one of them. It was ruled by a Hindu ruler with large, massive majority of Muslims, was contingent next to Pakistan. There was also Hyderabad, the richest person in the world. One of them ruled it. He was a Muslim. The state was vast majority Hindu, mm-hmm. right? And that Hyderabad said, we want to go to Pakistan. Didn't kind of make sense. It's in the middle of India. Kashmir, the Hindu Raja says, I want to go to India. And Hyderabad gets incorporated into India. India sends their troops and so on and so forth. Kashmir gets stalled on the 1st of January 1948. As he said, after these tribals uprise in Kashmir, according to Pakistan, move into Kashmir from Pakistan, according to India, India goes to the United Nations. The United Nations says, hey, guys, stop. Hold off. And that's what the line of control is. The longest serving UN peacekeeping mission or observation mission still exists on that border. It is the longest standing UN dispute. India and Pakistan says, okay, we will stop. We will do some sort of an agreement. We will do a plebiscite, meaning mm-hmm. a referendum. Madeleine Albright's father is sent to Kashmir. Still the best report ever that seriously tried to solve it was by him. The plebiscite never happens.
Right.
Pakistan claims India was never serious about giving the people of Kashmir voice. India claims that Pakistan didn't live up to some of the other clauses of that UN agreement, such as moving all troops back. And there we are. And now we are in not 1948, but in 2019. In between, there have been multiple major wars. Very briefly, you said two nuclear powers. It's not two, it's three.
With China.
Because the 62 war with China, China now has control and claim of about a fourth, a little less than a fourth. India has about 2/3. Pakistan has a fourth. No, China doesn't have a fourth. The remaining is China claimed.
Well, actually, on exactly that note, let's go to Martha, who's calling from New Orleans. Martha, did you have a question about Chinese involvement in this Kashmir issue?
Indeed, I did. Hello. I was calling about Ladakh and the disputed line of control there. And if you foresee or predict that this increasing tension, the division of Jammu and Kashmir, and creating Ladakh as a new state, if China's going to use this opening to take over more territory in Ladakh. And if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well,
appreciate it.
Martha, thank you for your call. So, Ravi, do you have an answer for Martha?
Well, it's a very good question because, you know, India and China have also fought wars in the past, and there's been sort of an uneasy peace between them, not only on the Kashmir side of the border, but also, I mean, the two also share a border more towards the eastern part of India as well. And of course, Nepal sandwiching them. So they've shared problems for quite a while. I mean, so the status of Ladakh now is that India has sort of, in its move on August 5th, has divided Kashmir into sort of union territories. So there's Kashmir, Indian administered Kashmir, and then Ladakh as well, which now sort of falls directly under New Delhi's control. China has clearly not been happy about this move, but I think it's fairly unlikely at this stage that the two are actually going to actively exchange hostilities on that border.
I agree. I think, you know, China has always been much less hot-headed than either India and Pakistan, at least on the public statements. But it clearly has a stake, including in the UN Security Council discussions that were held. Here is the other China thing that is very interesting. If you try to understand Kashmir, if you're not following South Asia and want to understand it, you know, here is a territory that had its own flag, is disputed, but the status quo was, let's keep the dispute there. The similar territory in the Chinese context would be something like Hong Kong. They're not exactly the same. But in a way, with China and India both rising, both are asserting this thing. What India has done is said, you know, what was considered disputed territory till now? Nope. Now it's ours. And what you see happening in Hong Kong in some ways is, again, China sort of saying, we are strong enough, we are assertive enough, we will now sort of not let these things move. Now, they're different. Mm-hmm. But what I'm getting at is, here are two major powers rising. And in their treatment of Muslim, whether it's China or here in India, it is their assertion of power. It is their changing of sort of historical gray area status quo. There are parallels.
Right. Well, so let's talk a little bit more then about Modi's reasoning for really triggering this latest dramatic increase in tensions regarding Kashmir here, because in a speech celebrating Indian Independence Day, Narendra Modi said that his new Kashmir policy would essentially bring India back to a form of greatness. So here is an excerpt from his speech with interpretation from the German news agency Deutsche Welle.
It can greatly contribute to India's development journey. We should all make an effort to restore their old glorious days. The new arrangement is a result of these efforts, and it will work directly in the interest of citizens.
That's Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. You heard his voice there through a translator. Ravi Agrawal, what is Modi's motivation here? What is he actually trying to accomplish? Because inside India, as far as I understand, amongst many Indians, this move is actually quite popular, even though it's received heavy criticism internationally.
That's correct. And I think the popularity may indeed signal some of the reasoning of why Modi went for this move. I mean, the public line, of course, is, as you just heard, that this is good for the economy, that it would bring Kashmir closer into the Indian Union, that it would make it more like other Indian states without autonomies, that there would be greater integration, that it would eventually improve the security situation in Kashmir. That's the official line. But it's worth pointing out that for many years now, this has been part of the BJP's manifesto. The BJP is Narendra Modi's political party, the Bharatiya Janata Party. For many years, it has been part of their manifesto to revoke the autonomies that were revoked on August the 5th. And so in some senses, this has been widely telegraphed for a while, in that while it was a little bit of a shock, it should not be surprising. And in his second term, Modi has just returned to power in May in a landslide victory for a second term. In his second term now, he is actually fulfilling many of the things that are actually in his manifesto, in his campaign manifesto. And this is one of those things that is quite popular within India. And I should point out as well that it comes amid a mood of rising nationalism, amid a mood of Indians being more prideful of who they are, hearkening back to a greater era, teasing the Hindu sort of identity of, as Narendra Modi likes to say, of India's past. And so there are all of those things that tie into this move in Kashmir. I mean, it comes amid several other moves by Modi's BJP, which in some senses polarize and divide Hindus and Muslims. And that has proved to be a very successful campaign and re-election strategy for his BJP. So all of those things are part of some of the thinking and reasoning behind why the move was made. There are also some who've been reporting and saying that perhaps this move on August 5th was brought forward by weeks, maybe even months. And this comes after Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan was in Washington about a month ago, speaking to U.S. President Donald Trump. And in those talks, perhaps they were about Afghanistan, but Khan may have said or may have invited Trump to do something about Kashmir or mediate in some form. Trump then, at a press conference, said he would be very glad to mediate between the two countries on Kashmir. That did not go down well in India because it is a tenet of Indian foreign policy that it will accept no mediation whatsoever in Kashmir. So there was a lot of pushback there, and some reporting indicates that India moved forward its plans in Kashmir because of that.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Adil Najam, go ahead.
Agreed, except for the last part. I'm not sure it would have been moved because of that little moment that neither Imran Khan nor Donald Trump had probably thought about. Both of them are prone to say things without thinking about it. But generally, I think Ravi is exactly right. This really is not just about Kashmir for Mr. Modi. It is about making India great again. But by great, he means sort of this Hindutva. You know, it's interesting. This is an assault not just on Kashmir and the constitution in that sense, but on Nehru's vision of a secular India. That's the Indian story. But the international story is a different one, too. That is really about the human rights issue. And that's not even a Pakistan story. Today is day 35.
Right.
Now, just breathe this in. Day 35 of the world's largest open prison, which is Kashmir. There are 1 million troops with a population of 8 million. What that means is one soldier for every 8. What does that mean? If you're in Srinagar, there is more than one soldier per house. Right. So that is what in this moment of sort of rising India, of India's great image, this has the internal debate as well as the international debate is, which India are we talking about?
Right.
The rising, shining, great power India or these images? Now, if Mr. Modi could, I'm quite sure he would want the curfew to be lifted, the internet to be opened again, people to be able to open shops, people to be moved. He doesn't like the photographs coming from there. But the question is, if he is forced to keep on day 35 this prison of Kashmir, the single largest militarized spot on earth. I repeat, the single largest militarized spot on earth today is Kashmir. Right? Why is he doing it? Because I'm assuming he would love to not have to do it, but the alternative isn't there.
Well, let's listen to the recent response on the Kashmir issue from the United Nations itself. Here's UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet contradicting Indian officials about their claim that they're getting everything back to normal in Kashmir. This was in Geneva earlier today.
I am deeply concerned about the impact of recent actions by the government of India on the human rights of Kashmiris, including restrictions on internet communication and peaceful assembly, and the detention of local political leaders and activists. While I continue to urge the governments of India and Pakistan to ensure that human rights are respected and protected, I have appealed particularly to India to ease the current lockdowns or curfews.
That's the UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet. I mean, Ravi, we've got about a minute here to go before we have to take a quick break. What do we know about what the situation on the ground in Kashmir is today? Are restrictions being lifted?
Well, it's very murky, and it would help if they allowed international journalists to go inside. Some restrictions in certain parts of Kashmir are beginning to be lifted. Some markets are maybe open in the mornings, for example. Some landlines have been restored. But the biggest thing is that if you're in Srinagar, in the Kashmir Valley, the most restive parts of the state, you really can't move about easily. People aren't going to school. Businesses are still shut down. And crucially, the internet is shut down. And we can talk about this more after the break, I guess. But India has more internet shutdowns than any other place in the world, and Kashmir is ground zero of those internet shutdowns. Imagine your life without the internet. If you're an Uber driver, if you are a small business owner, if you're taking your SATs. For Kashmiris, they have lived already for 36 days without it, and there could be more to come.
Well, Ravi Agarwal and Adil Najam, stand by for just a moment. We are trying to understand the latest in what's happening in Kashmir and the rising tensions. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the situation in Kashmir and those tensions between India and Pakistan. I'm joined today in the studio by Adil Najam. He's Dean of the Party School of Global Studies at Boston University. Ravi Agarwal also joins us. He's in New York. He's managing editor at Foreign Policy and co-author of its South Asia Brief newsletter. Also author of India Connected, How the Smartphone is Transforming the World's Largest Democracy. And Ravi, on that note, before the break, you were talking about the Indian government shutting down the internet and most, if not all, communications or telecommunications in Kashmir and the effect that that's having. So tell us more.
Sure. And it's funny you mentioned the name of my book, India Connected, but really what we're looking at is India disconnected here in Kashmir. This is a part of the world that has more internet shutdowns than any other place on earth. Syria and Iraq are, I think, ranked the second and third worst countries in the world, and India has more internet shutdowns than those two combined. What is an internet shutdown? Well, how that works is when the state essentially just tells every single internet provider and mobile operator to just switch off internet cellular services. And that means that most people, in fact, all people, simply cannot get online. The point of it is to prevent, India says, terrorists or militants from being able to communicate and disseminate information from protesters assembling. But really what it does is it makes for a gigantic collateral damage across the state, with millions of people unable to go about their daily lives in a normal way, with businesses being impacted, with students being affected. It really has been a giant collateral damage exercise. And this is just in the past 36 days, but it is not as if this hasn't happened before. I mean, in 2016, for example, Kashmir did not have the internet for all of 6 months after a period of insecurity and clashes between militants and the government. So that's sort of the backdrop of some of the security clampdown in Kashmir. And the problem for India is that the minute it tries to reduce some of that clampdown, you would see protests, you could see clashes, and that's exactly what it doesn't want.
So, especially on the last point, exactly right, Ravi is exactly right. But, you know, Ravi had asked to your listeners to imagine life without internet. And scary as that might be, if you do have internet, go and see what is coming out of Kashmir. It's one thing not to have, you know, able to call an Uber or whatever. But what is coming out are stories of rapes, stories of 13 years, pictures of 13-year-olds being held up, disappearing, and being tortured, stories of massive violence, stories of police control of an extreme worst case. Now, again, this is the age we live in, so which stories do you believe? Let's suppose Most of them are wrong. Let's suppose 99% of them are wrong. Let's suppose only one of them is right. Even these are the type of stories, even one of them is right. This is A, horrendous, tarnishes the image of India as a great power that wants to be in the Security Council itself at a very massive. So in some ways, what Ravi was saying, especially at the end, is important. The issue is alive, not because Pakistan is keeping it alive, but because the Kashmiri people have kept it alive. Mm-hmm. And now, because of these actions, Mr. Modi is keeping it alive.
Well, but the Indian government would say and is saying through military spokespeople that many of their efforts are essentially counterterrorism efforts, right, in Kashmir. Like, here's Kanwaljeet Singh Dhillon, who leads the Indian Army operations in the Kashmir Valley. Just last week, he told reporters that attacks from Pakistani-aligned militia groups have increased since India voted to remove Kashmir's autonomous status.
All the launch pads across the line of control are full of terrorists of various tanzims, and every day and night, the terrorist activities of infiltration are being attempted. As of now, the information available with us from the hinterland, there is not a single infiltration attempt which has been successful in Kashmir Valley, and this I can assure you.
Ravi Agarwal, is that part of the Indian government's justification here for the continuation of this lockdown?
Sure, it is. Some of those claims are not without merit, actually. I mean, the Indian-administered part of Kashmir has seen militantism, it has seen separatism, it has seen terrorism. Some of it is indigenous, some of it is because some Kashmiris want their own state, they want autonomy. In some cases, some Kashmiris say they want to be a part of Pakistan. In many cases as well, Kashmiris say they want to be a part of India. So it's mixed. They've asked for a referendum, they've never been given one. But where the Indian case has some merit, I would say, and is that, of course, over the last few decades, Pakistan has actually not been a good faith actor in Indian-administered Kashmir. It has allowed for militants who have maybe been sponsored by the Pakistani intelligence service to go across the border, help train other militants. And those are things that India has long objected to. And I think that's part of the reasoning behind India's clampdown in Kashmir. It is not justified. Mm. It is certainly a bad look for India. It certainly does not behoove the world's largest democracy to act the way it has. But by and large, in India, the security justification is one that has been used internally. And it's worth noting that this is a very popular argument in India. There's no hard data behind this, but anecdotally, it's fairly clear that most Indians are in favor, actually, of a continuing clampdown in Kashmir. And they see this sort of the pact, the Faustian pact between hard security and wider safety of the territory and of the Indian state as something they're willing to take.
Well, let's go to some callers here before we run out of too much time. Bridges is calling from Tampa, Florida. Bridges, you're on the air.
Hey, I have a quick question for both guests you have. One is, on what basis they make these comments without, because I personally think it's very biased opinion from both of them, because Jammu and Kashmir is not just a valley area of three or four districts. It's a state of, they have a Jammu, they have Ladakh, which was part of it. Now it's a union territory, and they do have a Kashmir area. And the root cause of the problem, according as an Indian, I know it's basically in three or four districts of Kashmir, not the entire state. And that's where the internet and everything is shut down at this moment. If you go to Jammu, internet access is there. In Ladakh, it is working. So they are making a huge deal out of it because we have this problem for last 70 years. So now the government is trying to fix it. If you have a better solution, talk about it rather than keep criticizing,
Well, Bridges, thank you so much for your call. And Adil and Dhamini, turn to you, because we actually haven't mentioned Jammu in the whole sort of region of Jammu and Kashmir, Jammu being the Hindu majority portion of the region. But do you have a response for him? He's saying that what India's doing is right in Kashmir.
Well, that part I don't know about, but at a general level, he's correct. the focal point, the center of the crisis has always been the Valley of Kashmir, which is the by far the vast majority of the place. So yes, there are these very sparsely populated, and it's not just on the Indian side, right? So there's a part that is controlled by India that we're talking about. There's a fourth of the of it that's controlled by Pakistan. There's also Gilgit and Baltistan, that's if you're really going to look at it, right? So there are no good faith actors here, right? So the Indian hurt at being Pakistan not being good faith is not incorrect, but it's still not as serious. Neither Pakistan nor India have been very good faith actors in this. But the real point is that where I don't agree is that, you know, we are making too much of a deal of it. If you look at, we're talking about an 8 million people place.
Yeah.
We are talking about the vast majority of that 8 million. And we are talking about atrocities at a very high level. Now, the fact about, you know, the statement you had run earlier by the Indian official, one interesting part is he's saying there has been no infiltration since this. If that is correct, and I think it is, because Pakistan is no longer capable of that, then the rise is indigenous. Now, from a Pakistan side, Imran Khan has another pressure, which is an internal pressure for not doing anything on Kashmir.
Mm.
There are groups in Pakistan which would want a much more strong militant, right? And if you read the news yesterday, Pakistan put some of them in jail, because the nightmare scenario for Pakistan is that there will be conflict, because it will, for Mr. Modi, be good, because it will distract attention. And it's not as Pakistan doesn't have other problems to deal
right,
with.
Right, right. Let's go to Zahur, who's calling from Syracuse, New York. Zahur, you're on the air.
Zahra, hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the speaker, Mr. Agarwal, was saying that one of the issues in Kashmir is a security issue. He talked about militants. He talked about terrorists. I think that those comments are conveniently simple, and they really distract from what is really happening in Kashmir. What I saw in Kashmir is droves of Indian soldiers just occupying every single main street, neighborhood, people getting shot down by pellet guns, children as young as 10 years old being taken out of their homes at night and just sent to unknown centers. Pakistan is the one that's engaging diplomatic avenues like the UN. India is the one that's saying, no, everybody just shut up. We're going to do whatever we want. We can kill, we can shoot, and there's just no impunity. There's no legality for their actions. There's no procedure. There's no rule of law. So that's the real situation. I would like to hear more about that.
Thank you so much for your call. Ravi, would you like to respond to her?
Yeah, of course. Hey, Zaha, I agree with you, actually. What I was saying earlier about the security situation was not my take. That was the government line. And I agree with you that the situation on the ground is quite dire. One of the problems is that reporting from there has not been easy. Indian journalists who are Indian citizens can get inside, but many foreign journalists are struggling to get visas to go inside there. So that's long been a problem. Remember as well, I was a former broadcast journalist. When you don't have the internet, it's not easy to broadcast live from a region. So that's another problem behind sort of being able to report cleanly and accurately and live from the region. But all of the things you say are true. They are happening. And one of the good things about us being able to have this discussion is that India does need to be criticized. There are two issues here. One is the legality of whether India's actions should be allowed or not. And that is something for New Delhi to decide, in a sense, because the actions were taken on Indian-administered Kashmir. The Supreme Court is hearing whether those actions are legal or not. And that's a separate matter. The other thing is the social and the security situation there, the clampdown. And on that front, there has actually been a bit of international attention around this. There needs to be more. And that's one of the things that all of us as journalists and activists can do, which is to ask tough questions of the Indian government.
I would, you know, he's exactly right. And I wouldn't want to put words in Ravi's mouth. But I do think what Ravi was saying earlier is correct. It's not as if there aren't militants. Right? The Indian government is claiming that. And it's, as he said rightly, it's not that there are none. There are no good actors in this one. Right. But the issue that comes is that, you know, every time a 13-year-old is killed, he's supposed to be a terrorist leader. Everyone does that. India is doing that now. When the U.S. hits villages in Afghanistan mm-hmm. that are having a wedding, supposedly the whole wedding party is a terrorist camp. When Pakistan does something in its tribal areas that goes, you know, array and young people die, suddenly they are terrorists. So it's not black and white. But unfortunately, there's much more darkness here than right. even there was earlier.
Well, I want to just listen to the voice for a moment of Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, because he spoke to the Pakistani parliament last Tuesday, warning that India's clampdown in Kashmir and increased tensions between the two nations could blow back on the entire world. And Prime Minister Imran Khan there speaking in Urdu, saying its implications will affect the whole world. And the next question is if I am doing nuclear blackmail. No, I am not blackmailing on nuclear. I am appealing to common sense, hoping for the best but preparing for the worst. Is the world prepared for the worst? That's Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan speaking last week. So, Ravi Agarwal, we've just got a couple of minutes, and I want to hear from both you and Adil on this big question here, because, you know, Kashmir itself is a major problem and a major concern for the international community. The nuclear question makes it that much more urgent. I mean, what is Khan saying in the excerpt that we just played here?
Well, Khan's hands are tied. He needs to appear tough at home. He needs to be able to tell Pakistanis that he is outraged, as I'm sure he is, that the state wants to do something. But he's also said quite helplessly, my hands are tied. It is not only that, but I think it's worth pointing out there's a wee bit of hypocrisy as well on Pakistan's stance, because on the one hand, they appeal to the fact that Muslims are being mistreated in Kashmir, which they are. But Pakistan itself, for example, has not once been able to say that Muslims are being mistreated in Xinjiang in China, because it's beholden to mm-hmm. Beijing. So, you know, on that front, what Pakistan is doing is what it has to do, which is to play the internal political game. I actually don't think it can do that much. I think its hands are tied. And on the nuclear issue, I mean, we are exactly where we were a year ago or 5 years ago, in that it would first take some sort of a spark or a skirmish for things to get more serious. And I think both sides have realized that it is that spark and skirmish which needs to be avoided. Right. The two came to the brink of blows in February, you might remember. They were wise enough to pull back. And one of the ironies is that the jingoism in the media on either side has actually allowed both sides to claim victories where there are none. Yeah. Well, so it's a very strange situation.
I just want to give Adil a chance to... We've got 45 seconds.
Ravi is generally correct, including on the China's Muslim point. I'm only less sanguine on that they've learned. They've been very good, reasonable players on nuclear, both of them till now, but I don't think it's the same as 5 years ago. In March, India actually entered Pakistan territory. Pakistan shot down a plane, returned the pilot. But the thing is, that has changed India's appetite. Imran Khan there was responding to an Indian minister of defense saying, we are ready to use nuclear first if we need to. So some of this is jingoism, but, you know, this is a hot-headed part of the world. Someone needs to come in and say, guys, step back. This is a world problem. That has to be the UN or the US or some other major power.
Well, Adil Najam, Dean of the Party School of Global Studies at Boston University, thank you. And Ravi Agarwal, Managing Editor at Foreign Policy and co-author of its South Asia Brief Newsletter, thank you both so very much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.